Welcome to Tech Tuesday on All Sides with Anna Staver, a show where we bring you different stories about science, technology, and the future of our environment. Our first topic is the future of gaming in Ohio, as the state considers bringing casino games and lottery tickets straight to your phone, turning those physical scratch-off tickets you buy at the grocery store into digital cards you purchase through an app. A special committee here in Ohio is drafting a report on what the future of gaming should look like. David Corey is Executive Vice President of the Bowling Centers Association of Ohio. He is among those advocating for an expansion of businesses allowed to have low-stakes gambling machines, but he's concerned about these iLottery and iCasino ideas. Welcome to All Sides, David.
Thank you for having us today, Anne.
It's kind of crazy to think that, you know, those physical scratch-off tickets that you, like, you know, rub with a quarter could just be scratched off on an app on your phone. What are we really considering here?
Well, we're considering expanding gaming on 8 million cell phones, basically, with little or no way to make sure that that's happening with adults.
Yeah, so essentially it would allow lottery tickets to be sold, so anything from Mega Millions to those scratch-off tickets. Mm-hmm. And then iCasinos would allow games like blackjack, like poker, right? Like sort of the casino experience, but in the palm of your hand.
Right, and it's all very troubling to Ohio's small business hospitality establishments because since the expansion of gaming, which occurred with the constitutional amendment allowing casinos in the state of Ohio, and then it expanded into video lottery terminals in racetracks. We call those racinos. And then two other most recent expansions. And, you know, the Ohio General Assembly has done a pretty good job in being deliberate and methodical in these expansions. Now we're also allowed to have e-bingo machines in fraternal and veteran clubs. So e-bingo machines are basically slot machines. So you have fraternal clubs that have these e-bingo machines. And then sports betting has come to the state of Ohio too. So if you look at all those segments, you've picked winners and losers. And what we're saying, the hospitality establishments in Ohio, which are primarily family-owned businesses, restaurants, bars, bowling centers, we're saying we've been left out of this. So before you expand it anymore from digitally, please take care of the bricks and mortar stores that have really made the lottery what it is today. If you think about it, you know, some of the best keno locations are bowling centers. And bars. So we've been partners with the state of Ohio for a number of years, and we think our proposal to bring video lottery terminals to age-restricted bars and bowling centers in age-restricted areas is the next thing to do, next step in the expansion of gaming, because it's in a controlled manner. You're looking at 8,000 locations. You're not looking at 8 million cell phones.
And so essentially you want to have those digital scratch-off tickets available in sort of a kiosk, a tabletop game in a section of the bowling alley.
Correct. Yes, a dedicated kiosk, a video lottery terminal, similar to what they're...
So like a slot machine that you might sit at in like a casino, but it does these other kinds of games.
Right. Correct.
And you know what's interesting is, you know, you referenced sports betting, and we are allowed to bet on sports games now on our phones. And what I found really interesting from the initial data from that first year of sports betting is I want to say more than 90%, I think it was 95% of it, is happening digitally. So if given the option, especially when you get into millennials, Gen Z, and like people under 40, under 30, they're preferring to do it digitally.
That is the case in some situations, but... you know, there's different type of gamblers in the state of Ohio. There's bingo players, there's lottery players, there's casino players, there's players that want to play in fraternal and veterans clubs. So what we're saying is, and what we're asking is, just level the playing field a little bit. The gambling pie is a big pie, and all we're looking at is a small piece, because we're trying to keep people in and attract people in our locations. I'll give you an example. You've got a bowling center. You've got league bowlers on a Tuesday night that are bowling in their league. And then there happens to be a fraternal club next door or across the street. So what happens after they do their league bowling? They leave. They go over to the Fraternal and Veterans Club and they play the games. And so we want to just keep butts in seats, so to speak, keep people in our establishments and just try and level the playing field a little bit.
You know, one of the things that online sports betting apps offer is incentives, like free bets or like quote unquote free money. Essentially, we could argue about whether it's really free to get people in, to hook them. But that's not available for in-person kiosks, correct?
You're absolutely right. When sports betting came to the state of Ohio, there was supposed to be a universal start date for online app betting and also on the lottery kiosks that are in a lot of our bowling centers and in our bars. But unfortunately, again, it wasn't a level playing field where those kiosks couldn't do what the apps were doing, is allowing those enticing free money bets, etc. So again, we're not having in Ohio, there's not a level playing field, and that's what really disturbs us. And that's where we think if they go the iLottery route or the iCasino route, once again, Ohio's small businesses are going to be left behind. Because if they do, if the state does authorize VLTs and bars and bowling centers, it takes care of a couple of things. Number one, we have an illegal gaming issue in the state of Ohio. We've got illegal...
There are brick-and-mortar places that are doing it illegally, right?
Well, yeah. We've got these strip shopping centers that have these Lucky You and, you know, Spin to Win. And those locations, we don't really know what's going on in there, but I think we can all guess. And the Casino Control Commission and law enforcement have done a good job of shutting those down. But once they shut one down, they go to another township and they open up again. The other thing that we can provide the state of Ohio is an enormous amount of tax revenue that's not mandated. It's a voluntary, quote, a voluntary tax when people play these games. You're looking at a potential, and we've got a University of Cincinnati Applied Economics Research Institute did a study for us, and they estimate that there could be direct tax revenue to the state of Ohio of $476 million, and also in addition, $32.5 million in license fees. Now, the members of the General Assembly are talking about property tax relief. They've been wanting to do away with the state income tax for a number of years. So where are the replacement dollars going to come from? We dwarf iCasinos and iLotteries in terms of the revenue we can generate. And you just have to look to Illinois and some other states that have done this. Illinois allows VLTs and bars and bowling centers, and their revenue is double what I'm just saying. So there's a potential of even greater. But again, we don't like to oversell and under-deliver. I think we went down that road before with the casinos. They oversold it and they under-delivered. We're not like that. We're not going to play that game. And the reason why we can deliver it is because in our proposal, the tax rate is 50%. The casino tax rate is 30%. It's the lowest tax rate in the country because they wrote the law. It's in our Constitution. So we want to be fair to Ohio and Ohioans. We want to do it the right way, and we think our proposal is the way to go if they consider expanding.
Now, I know this is beyond the scope of what you cover or what you represent, but, you know, there are some people who work with people struggling with gambling addiction, and they have real concerns, and I just want to put it out there, that they have real concerns about adding iLottery, iCasino onto phones and what that will mean, giving very easy access to people struggling not to place bets, people struggling not to gamble. But I did want to ask, sort of in that vein, there are people who just oppose any kind of gambling exemption, right? They didn't like the casinos. They don't like sports betting. What do you say to somebody that, like, any kind of expansion is wrong?
Well, I say that the horse is out of the barn, so to speak, and it's here, and it's not going anywhere. And all we're saying is let Ohio small businesses, hospitality establishments that are primarily family-owned, take part in it in a controlled secure manner. My clients, they agree. 8 million cell phones is the wrong way to go. Two machines per location, in an age-restricted area, where their revenues can be generated to help with the problem gambling issue. You could earmark some of these dollars for that. So I think there's always a way to look at expansion of gaming in a controlled manner that takes care of some of those concerns. But again, we're not going backwards. We'll tell you that right now, we're not. And we just hope that the Study Commission on the Future of Gaming in Ohio realizes that bricks and mortars, really the backbone of what's made the lottery so successful. I mentioned the Keno, the Keno example, that they look to us to take care of us first and take care of our small businesses. They're having a hard time paying their property taxes. They're having a hard time paying their license fees, et cetera. You know, a few extra $1,000 can really go a long way in the hospitality industry, because some really haven't even recovered from COVID yet. I mean, you got to look at that too. So,
you also represent the Ohio Coin Machine Association. First of all, what is that? And what position are they taking in these discussions?
Well, they're partners with the Bowling Centers Association of Ohio. They've been partners with them for many, many years. I'm also the executive vice president of the Ohio Coin Machine Association, too. And those are the companies that operate jukeboxes, pool tables, video games.
Oh, anything where you put the coins into play.
Electronic dart boards.
Gotcha.
In bars and taverns. In fact, they just finished yesterday their 43rd annual state 8-ball billiards championships in Canton, Ohio, where we had 1,800 pool players playing on 88 pool tables to be crowned champion. And it's the third largest amateur 8-ball tournament in the country behind Minnesota,
Wisconsin. I did not know that. Wow.
That event is the second biggest thing in Canton, Ohio, next to Hall of Fame weekend.
Oh, my goodness. So that's a big moneymaker for them.
The city. It's a big economic impact. Big economic impact.
So what? How do they factor into this conversation? Is it the idea that maybe you play a digital scratch-off and then maybe you play a game of pool?
Well, it would be in a public-private partnership. The coin machine industry, those businesses would purchase the equipment.
Oh.
Okay, and they would place the equipment, gotcha. Service the equipment, et cetera. So that's the way it's done in many states. It's a public-private partnership. That way, the state of Ohio has no capital outlay in buying the equipment. Private sector, public-private partnership. That's what works the best. If we've seen the rollout of sports betting. Didn't really work that great with the kiosks. I mean, government does a lot of great things. Believe me, they do. But sometimes in this area, maybe not so good. And we think we've got the answer, and we're going to do what other states have done to be successful.
How receptive have lawmakers been to these proposals?
Well, you know, if you look back on the history of this issue, in 1994, Governor George Voinovich convened the first Gaming Study Commission, okay? And we know what happened in the last, 20 years since then. You know, this state was not in favor of expanded gaming at all. And then the floodgates opened up. And I think this General Assembly is realizing that Ohio's bricks and mortars, hospitality establishments have been left behind. And there is a way to ensure that this is expansion is done in a controlled manner with the highest benefit to the state of Ohio and also to help out Ohio small businesses. So it's an education process. You know, we've been at this for 30 years now, but I think we're getting a little bit more traction. I think this study, you know, this commission to study the future of gaming is really a great first step. And the reception has been much better than in past years.
I want to end by asking you a bit of a weird question. There was this book that came out a while back called Bowling Alone. And it was all about the rise of loneliness here in America and the disappearance of what we call third places, which are not your work and not like your home, but it's a place where you can get together and you can hang out and spend time with friends in person. Do you see bowling alleys and these kinds of places Like, is it, are they important for more than just the bowling or the gaming? Essentially, like, is the value in keeping them going more in preserving these communal spaces?
You know, that's a great question, Anne, and a great comment too. And you hit the nail right on the head. Bowling centers, they do so much in the community. You know, a few years back, we got bowling designated as a varsity letter sport. Okay, so, you know, you don't have to be 6'4" and weigh 260 to bowl. You know, you can be 5'1" and 100 pounds, and you can be a good bowler. So it starts with the youth, and then, you know, these centers, they have family entertainment centers. They do so many birthday parties and so many retirement parties in these bowling centers. So you hit the nail right on the head. But to be able to do that and to be able to support the local charities that bowling centers do, they need to be able to compete on a level playing field. And I just get back to that over and over again. That's the biggest issue we have. There's no level playing field. And we've had many bowling centers close in the last 5 years. And that's not a good thing for Ohio, because you're absolutely right. They're great community partners, and they need to thrive and survive.
That was David Corey, Executive Vice President of the Bowling Centers Association of Ohio. Thank you for joining us today.
Thank you very much. Really appreciate it.
Coming up, we're talking about an engineering experiment to cool the earth with clouds. That's when All Sides continues on 89.7 NPR News.
At a time when information continues to come at us faster and faster, sometimes you need to hit pause and rewind. NPR's Throughline takes you back in time to the source of the news stories filling your feed. Find NPR's Throughline wherever you get your podcasts.
You're listening to Tech Tuesday on All Sides with Anna Staber, a show where we bring you different stories about science, technology, and the future of our environment. What if clouds were the solution to global warming? Scientists recently tested this theory, turning white, fluffy clouds into soggy mirrors. I'm not kidding. Here to explain the science is Christopher Flavell, a climate correspondent for the New York Times. Welcome to All Sides, Chris.
Hi, thanks for having me.
Clouds as mirrors. Can you explain that?
Sure. You know, it's at one level, it's just what you said. The idea here is that clouds have a natural degree of reflectivity. They will bounce some portion of the sunlight that hits them back up into the air, back into space. And so scientists have for some time been working on this idea of what if you could sort of artificially adjust that reflectivity. You could increase the amount of sunshine, solar energy that was bounced off these clouds back up into space. Could you do that, A, at all? And B, could you do it enough at a large enough scale that it might have a meaningful effect in terms of temporarily, artificially cooling the planet as sort of a defense against global warming?
So how do we increase the reflectivity of clouds? Like, what are we shooting into the atmosphere? I assume it's shooting.
And shooting is one verb that works. The idea is to find a way to move aerosols into clouds, an airborne particle. Not just any aerosol. It has to be just the right size. And this is the subject of one of the experiments that I got to witness recently. The idea is, Can scientists develop a machine, they call it a nozzle or a sprayer, that can produce and shoot just the right size particle into clouds? Because if you do, through something called the Toomey effect, you can create a greater number of smaller particles in these clouds. And together, they have the effect of, again, increasing that reflectivity, but only if it works.
So Tell us about this first test that you went to watch. You were on a boat. Can you kind of set the scene for us? Like, what's happening on the boat?
Sure. So I flew out to San Francisco a few weeks ago and went to a decommissioned aircraft carrier, the USS Hornet, that is docked in San Francisco Bay, and walked up gangplank to see a really surreal scene. There were a series of scissor lifts interspersed at careful intervals down the length of this long, long flight deck. And then at one end, sort of facing the scissor lifts, each of which had complex, sensitive scientific instruments on them, at sort of the running the show was what you could think of as like a spotlight or a snow blower. And it's, again, sort of a sprayer device. And this thing does two things. It smashes up aerosol particles, sea salt particles, and then projects them down the length of this flight deck. And the goal is to see if, number one, can they create the right size aerosols to do what they want to do? And number two, do the aerosols maintain their size as they rush through the air? If they clump together and you get a smaller number of larger particles, the whole thing not only won't work, but might backfire. So this was sort of the first outdoor test in the US to see if this new technology, to actually make this plausible, to make this an available technology, if it worked.
And so how did this plan to turn clouds into soggy mirrors go? Did it work?
I just know that the goal with this initial set of tests or studies on the USS Hornet is not initially to actually influence clouds, to change clouds. The goal really is to test the machine that's been in development for some time to see if it can produce and shoot these aerosols in the way that the designers, the engineers intend. They're probably a long way off at this point from actually trying to make clouds brighter. Really the goal, based on my reporting, is just to know, can we do this? Is this a viable technology? It works sort of in models. It works in theory. Does it work if you're deliberately shooting these aerosols into the sky? And from the initial tests, the researchers I talked with seemed very optimistic and encouraged. They'll be working at this for months and months to test this device in different conditions. Again, trying to get to the point where they'll at least have the option, if they choose to proceed, to go out into probably the open ocean and try to actually brighten clouds and see if there's a cooling effect.
So a lot of work around global warming or combating climate change tends to focus on how we can reduce carbon emissions. This strikes me almost as an admission that they're here, that the world is probably not going to reduce carbon emissions by what we need to in a period of time. And so this strikes me as almost an alternative to that, as a, okay, this is happening. What can we do to reverse it?
Yeah, you know, the people who work in this field really go to great length to stress that in their view, this can't be instead of reducing greenhouse gas emissions. There's all kinds of reasons for that, but one good one is there are so many negative consequences of greenhouse gas emissions just temporarily bouncing back more sunlight to artificially cool the planet wouldn't deal with a lot of those negative consequences. And the scale you have to do it at would be just huge. So they stress really the same thing environmentalists stress, which is you really have to, any sort of meaningful plan to address global warming really has to continue to focus overwhelmingly on cutting greenhouse gas emissions. But having said that, their point is, by all the data and all the projections, it seems all but certain that the world will not cut greenhouse gas emissions fast enough to avoid really dangerous consequences from global warming. And so their point is, maybe we should start looking at alternative.
It looks like we're having a little bit of technical difficulty. We'll try to get him back on in just a moment. But one of the most interesting things in preparing for this episode, because, you know, what you were saying is that it can't completely reverse climate change, right? We can't seed enough clouds, turn them into enough mirrors to bring down the temperature of the Earth all over the Earth. But one of the things you talked about in your reporting that I found really fascinating was this idea of maybe using it in very targeted areas like coral reefs. Can you talk a little bit about that possibility?
Yeah, the idea of coral reefs is sort of a good idea, a good example of how this might be applied, right? If the goal was to reduce temperatures a little bit in one specific area of the ocean, say around the great coral reefs anywhere, but especially off the coast of Australia, could you do this in sort of a relatively contained area and help prevent or at least weaken some of the really dangerous effects, for example, the dying off of coral from really high ocean temperatures? So that's one of the sort of the use cases that you'll hear discussed with this kind of technology at some point.
Any idea on how this might affect precipitation or weather patterns? Like, are there concerns that this could be disruptive?
Yeah, so when I talk to researchers about what the concerns are and potential side effects, they say one of the big things is it will probably change, or it would change, precipitation patterns. It might change sort of ocean currents. It might change fishery health. And they're really upfront about not knowing those details. And they say one of the big goals of this research should be not just sort of the engineering task of shooting particles into the air, but also doing the studies to figure out what the consequences would be, which at the moment they don't seem to have a good handle on.
Is there concern about how big these consequences could be? And I guess I wonder how they're balanced against how big the consequences of climate change could be.
Yeah, and I think that's a useful framing. That's certainly the framing that researchers point to. They'll say, yes, there are definitely concerns here and definitely risks if this kind of approach, this kind of technology were to have unintended effects. But they stress that in their mind, the sort of right comparison point is not, are those risks big by themselves, but how do those risks compare to the sort of known risks of climate change that are already happening? And that's, you know, it's probably inherently subjective. It's hard to compare those kinds of risks. But I think the point they make is, compared to what's already happening in the world, perhaps the risks from this kind of solar geoengineering, as it's often called, are sort of reasonable enough that it's worth proceeding with more research.
And how far off do you think that first test out in the middle of the ocean is?
Yeah, I've heard different estimates. There was a sort of a series of tests, again, near Australia this year during the month of February, designed to get more data, but really still not quite intended to get sort of widespread temperature changes. So the idea of, the phrase you hear is deployment, the idea of deploying this technology in a way that's designed to actually achieve sort of meaningful temperature changes, meaningful cooling of the air or water. I heard estimates from, you know, a few years to a decade or more. I think probably the answer is going to depend on just how urgent it feels. That will determine how much money gets devoted to this research and probably how much leeway researchers have to go out into the ocean and try this technology.
Speaking of urgency, as a reporter who covers climate for a living, how urgent does it feel, or how urgent are scientists who study these issues? Like, you know, how long do we have? I guess we could argue whether the impacts of global warming, we're already feeling them, but how long until they start really affecting us significantly?
Yeah, as you said, it's a tough question to answer. One thing that I keep in mind, and I'll tell people, is I've been covering climate change for a decade, and specifically I focus on how people try to adapt to the effects of climate change. And I think back to even just 5 years ago when, you know, any single big disaster was sort of a huge deal, sort of define that year in the US. And now we have so many large-scale disasters in any given year that it's almost becoming hard to remember them. It's not like, if you think back, well, what was the biggest climate disaster in the US last year or 2 years ago? It's hard to think of one because there's so many. And so I think the rate at which the impacts of climate change are increasing is remarkable and probably meets your threshold of urgency, right? This question of we know which way things are going, but we don't really know how fast they're going. But it seems like that speed is picking up. And that seems to have most of the experts I talk to pretty worried about where we'll be in 2 or 5 or 10 years.
Cloud, what's the difference between this and cloud seeding, which is something we hear a lot about, or we also hear a lot of conspiracy theories about as well?
So I guess conceptually similar in the sense that you're trying to manipulate and affect the activity clouds. Cloud seeding, of course, is when you try to manipulate clouds in a way that you produce or you increase the amount of rainfall that those clouds produce in a given area. And cloud seeding has been done for a long time. You hear different ideas about how successful it is, somewhere between, I don't know, 5 to 10% maybe increased rainfall if done well. But the scale and the goals here are much different, right? The goals here are to change temperatures, even just temporarily. And that is sort of a monumental undertaking that doesn't really have any direct analog from how we live now.
And I just want to circle back. And so these particles that are going out into the air, because I realized I forgot to ask you, what are they made of? Because sometimes when we think of aerosolized particles, we think of global warming.
Yeah, it's a good point. And I think that's an important contrast. The goal or the idea here is to use sea salt particles, sort of smashed up tiny, 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 tiny sea salt particles as the aerosols in question. And when people, if people are thrown by that, research will note, we already kind of do this, but we do it in sort of an accidental or haphazard way. As you note, a lot of air pollution is also in the form of aerosols. And sometimes that can have the same effect. It can create sort of a haze or even thicken clouds. The point researchers make is if we're doing this deliberately, if we're intentionally trying to shoot aerosols into clouds, we can then choose the aerosol and do it not in the context of pollution. And so if you shoot up sea salt aerosols, they won't have the same sort of undesirable consequences as air pollution does.
That was Clist excuse me. That was Christopher Flavelle, a climate correspondent for the New York Times. Thank you for your time today.
Thank you so much.
Coming up, we're talking about why an electric car company wants to get into the cell phone business. That's when All Sides continues on 89.7 NPR News.
More than 6 months since the October Hamas attack on Israel, still no deal on hostages. Tens of thousands of Palestinians have been killed in Israel's assault on Gaza. With no peace in sight, what do ordinary Israelis want from their leaders?
Everybody went back to their business, to their jobs and so on and so forth, but they're still shut up.
That's on the next On Point. Later today at noon on 89.7 NPR News.
At a time when information continues to come at us faster and faster, sometimes you need to hit pause and rewind. NPR's Throughline takes you back in time to the source of the news stories filling your feed. Find NPR's Throughline wherever you get your podcasts.
You're listening to Tech Tuesday on All Sides with Anna Staver, where we bring you different stories about science, technology, and the future of our environment. There's a new handheld device that promises to do what your phone can do, but faster and better. It's called Rabbit R1. And here to tell us if it lives up to the hype is Russell Hawley, Managing Editor for Commerce at CNET. Welcome back, Russell.
Thank you.
So this device has been described as a real-life Pokedex, which is low-key hilarious to me. But for those who aren't Pokemon fans, what does that mean? And is that a fair description?
Sort of. This is a small red square. It's about half the size of a phone as far as like length goes. It's got a funny little scroll wheel and a camera that pops up when you ask it to. It's a really unique kind of, you know, pretty looking gadget with a great big button on the side. And when you push that great big button, you can ask the Rabbit R1 questions. And its whole shtick is that it uses AI to do those things for you. Not to just answer questions, but to reach into your phone and do things like schedule an appointment or, you know, kind of check on the status of a shipment and things like that. The point of this thing is supposed to be that you can rely on just asking questions of this little box instead of having to constantly reach for your phone.
And one example is like you can point it at a plant and it's supposed to be able to identify it.
That's right. Yeah. So it's got a camera that will flip around to either the front or the back, and you can, you know, push a button and say, tell me what I'm looking at. And this doesn't just work for plants. It works for buildings. It works for, you know, metro stops. There's a whole bunch of different things that the image recognition is supposed to be able to work on. And it does. But the things that happen next are often quite limited.
Yeah, and it's a separate device, I want to be clear, from your phone. It's like a little red square and with a black screen, and it's got some buttons down the side and, you know, a little rabbit on the like the center of it. But it works primarily by speaking to it, right? So we talk to this thing more than we would say talk to our phone.
Almost entirely, yeah. This is a spoken word platform. It has a scroll wheel so that you can navigate through some options if the screen provides you with that. But this is very much not a like poke and scroll around experience like you would have with your phone.
So what did CNET think of the device when they reviewed it?
It's so pretty, and it does almost nothing. the design on this thing is really great. There is a background company that helped design this thing. They also helped design a very similarly pretty device called the Playground. There are a lot of, you know, very cool concepts within this thing, like being able to push the button on the thing and say, you know, call an Uber for me. I want to go to this place. And in theory, eventually, this thing will get to a point where it can actually go into your Uber app and make all of those selections for you so that it doesn't actually need to worry about those things. But right now, in our testing, we have found that the battery only lasts about half a day. And that's with, you know, kind of pretty moderate use, not with, you know, kind of the same kind of use that I would put into my phone on a regular basis. And the things that it's actually capable of doing right now are just incredibly limited. This is very much a beta test that is being sold to you. It's you know, $200 for a very pretty red block that they promise will get much better over time.
And if you buy the red block now, it's software updates that are going to get better over time, or, you know, should I hold off for version 2 or 3?
What the company behind this, what Rabbit is claiming, is that the software updates rolled out to this over time and the improvements made to the AI over time for what they call this you know, kind of action-focused AI, where it's more about completing tasks than it is about generating silly images or making your voice sound like President Biden. There are, you know, the functionality here is that you should have this like personal assistant that lives in your pocket. And the funny thing about that is that I already have a personal assistant that lives in my pocket. It's just made by Apple and not by Rabbit.
So Rabbit isn't the only company trying to change the way we interact with other devices. There's something called the Human AI Pin. What is this?
Yeah, so this is a similar concept where it's a pin that you wear and it almost sits on your
like a lapel pin,
like a comm badge from Star Trek. You know, like it sits there and it's got like a laser projection system. So you hold out your hand and it'll display information on your hand through this laser projection, which visually very cool. Although, like most things, alongside that in broad daylight, doesn't work super great. And the battery on them isn't real great. You know, these are all really clever ideas. That are trying to utilize AI in ways that are actually, like, you know, practical and productive and geared towards making your life better so that you're not constantly staring down at a phone and doing something. But as far as what these things are actually capable of, it is not immediately clear that this is something that would replace the need to reach into your pocket and grab your phone anytime soon.
So we're not at the beam me up, Scotty, level yet.
We are definitely not there, but it's cool that there are so many companies thinking about it, because it does mean that, you know, that, that this is a concept that could very well get better with time. But this year, it seems incredibly unlikely that this is going to be something that gets recommended before the end of the year.
And it's pricey, this little AI pin.
Yeah, so the Humane one is, not only is it very expensive, but it comes with a monthly subscription to go along with it. If memory serves, is like $30 a month to access the AI service. Rabbit is half the price at $200 and does not have a subscription, which is great, in that, you know, your kind of initial expense up front is a lot less. But it's still $200 for a thing that isn't as functional as my phone that I have already paid for.
So it sounds like these are intriguing devices. They have a lot of potential, but they haven't really convinced you yet that you need another gadget.
I think this ends up being very similar to the concept of a smartwatch. You know, do I need an extension of my phone on my watch, on my wrist? The answer for smartwatches was for fitness stuff. You know, if I want to, you know what my heart rate is or track my pulse, or as Apple added, have like fall detection so that if an older person falls, that there is, you know, support for those people in those times. Or like when there's an accident or something like that, that kind of side accessory has kind of already been created in the form of something that you would wear on your wrist. The Rabbit R1, as cool as it looks, it is almost three times the size as my Apple Watch, and it has to live in a pocket, which, as gets pointed out on a regular basis, not everybody has.
Let's talk about phones. Smartphones specifically. So electric vehicle maker Polestar has a new product, and it's a phone. So it seems a little unusual that a car company would decide to release a phone. Why did they do it?
I think honestly, because they could, and because the Polestar branding is something that a lot of people think is very pretty, the kind of star logo that lives on the phone, and Polestar being you know, a Swedish automaker that has a lot of relationships in China, phones are really inexpensive to get made when you have a lot of those constructive relationships. So instead of doing what Tesla and Chevrolet and several other companies have done, where there is an app that you can install on your phone that gives you remote access to your car and all of its functionalities, Polestar just decided to make a whole phone in order to do this, using it is an Android-based phone made by a company called Meizu, which has made a couple of different phones that have been used in the past, and they're usually pretty middle of the road. But yeah, this is right around $1,000 for an Android phone that has the Polestar logo on the back.
It sounds a little bit like Apple's approach to things, where it's like you get the watch, you get the the phone, the iPad, the headphones, like everything talks and syncs and pairs with each other. It seems like Polestar is like, hey, we can make your car sync with your phone, with this, with that.
There's definitely some aspect of that. I also think that just having a phone with the Polestar logo on it for that particular audience is very much a status symbol kind of thing. You know, it's not just having, you know, if all of your car stuff lives on your phone, then you no longer have that Maserati key fob to show off what kind of car you've got, because it's all on your. So this is kind of the 2024 version of having the fancy car key to show off what it is that you have in the garage.
And this works both ways. Apple spent a decade creating an EV, but they ultimately scrapped that project.
That is exactly right. The promise of an Apple car was something that we're probably never going to actually see on the street somewhere. And, you know, given all of the excitement with the Cybertruck, that might be a good thing.
Speaking of the Cybertruck and Elon Musk, he's in a fight with a judge in Brazil. What is going on there?
That is exactly right. A version of this has cropped up a couple of times now, where Twitter or X now has made a decision about you know, what needs to happen in order for the platform to continue functioning in different countries, and there has been a legal disagreement. And what it seems like keeps getting forgotten in this mix is that that laws in other countries are not the same as laws in the US. So Elon Musk will regularly say, well, this platform has free speech, and so we believe in free speech here, so we're not going to remove, you know, accounts or behaviors that you're going to tell us to, because, you know, this is an American company and we're going to do things our way. So the legal dispute that comes here is there is a judge in Sao Paulo who has decided that there are far right extremists that are causing active damage on the streets of Sao Paulo and other places in Brazil on a regular basis. And they are using Twitter to organize things like hateful marches and attacks on individuals. And so the ruling came down that those accounts needed to be banned from Twitter to stop this kind of thing from happening. Elon Musk said no. It was not going to remove those accounts. And so the legal dispute then became whether it was appropriate for X to exist in Brazil at all, whether it should just be banned from the country as a whole. And that is essentially where this set of rules has come from, is Elon Musk has decided that only American laws regarding speech and things are the ones that he needs to follow in order for Twitter to continue existing. And that is probably not going to go his way, but it's only going to, you know, he has apparently a pretty great relationship with several other leaders in that country. So it's kind of a toss up right now as to how exactly that's going to go.
Yeah, my favorite part of this story is that Musk has described the Supreme Court justice as Brazil's Darth Vader. So
yes, and I in no way claim to be an expert in any shape or form in the way that the legal system functions in Brazil. I know that the way that the Supreme Court functions there is very different from the way that it proceeds here, and they also handle just an enormous number of cases compared to what our Supreme Court handles as a result of that kind of separate functioning. But it very much is not, as far as I can tell, Elon Musk versus the country of Brazil. It really does just seem to be this one Supreme Court justice against X, which is fascinating.
So I want to shift and circle back to T-Mobile. So the Federal Communications Commission has said it will approve T-Mobile's deal to acquire Kenea, I hope I'm saying that correct, Corporation, which owns prepaid wireless brands, that's a bit of a tongue twister, Mint Mobile and Ultra Mobile. So why does T-Mobile want to acquire these smaller companies?
Yeah, so Mint Mobile and Ultra Mobile are not what we would consider traditional carriers here in the United States. They buy bandwidth and service area from companies like T-Mobile and Verizon and AT&T, and they at this, you know, kind of bulk rate so that they can sell that service under their own brand name to other organizations. So a lot of folks may be familiar with the name Mint Mobile because it is now owned by Ryan Reynolds.
And I've a lot seen of those commercials. Ads.
Exactly. A lot of people have seen the Mint Mobile ads. Mint Mobile is a perfectly fine service as long as you are okay with the T-Mobile service, because that is essentially what it is. And, you know, with that comes an incredible amount of popularity. There are a lot of people who have actively left Verizon and AT&T and T-Mobile in order to go and use Mint Mobile, because it ends up being something like $15 a month for very few trade-offs compared to what you would get if you were just paying the $60 a month for T-Mobile. This indicates that the prepaid market that T-Mobile and Verizon and AT&T have dominated for so long just hasn't been working, because they've, you know, the goal has been to have those regular subscribers. So T-Mobile wants to buy this company back, really, because they've seen that Mint Mobile and its smaller subsidiary Ultra Mobile are just incredibly successful, almost entirely because of solid marketing.
So I want to ask, for Mint Mobile and Ultra Mobile customers, is anything going to change about their plans? Are they going to stay that cheap once they become part of the T-Mobile family?
The promise that's been made acquisition so far is that there are going to be very little changes in the way that the service is going to function. And it's not as though some folks may remember when T-Mobile acquired MetroPCS and kind of everything became T-Mobile. It doesn't seem like that is what T-Mobile is interested in here. It seems like they're interested in keeping Mint Mobile as kind of its own thing. But it's also important to keep in mind that Ryan Reynolds made this acquisition to begin with because as a Canadian citizen, he found that getting cell phone service in Canada was just a gigantic pain in the neck, and it required a 3-year contract, and there was a whole bunch of, you know, kind of things that needed to go into it. And so he invested a whole bunch of money into an alternative and has been working really hard to provide not just Canadians, but also Americans with an affordable alternative. So I think if T-Mobile were to deviate from that in some spectacular way, that it would backfire on them very quickly.
Is Ryan Reynolds still going to be in their commercials?
I honestly don't know the answer to that question. I kind of hope that he is, because while I've only used Mint Mobile 2 or 3 times since it has been around, and usually not more for a month or two, they're really entertaining commercials.
Yeah, T-Mobile has also entered into a joint venture with investment organization EQT to spend almost $1 billion to acquire a fiber internet provider. Are they expanding into like home internet? What's going on there?
It's likely that this is actually less about home internet and more about businesses. T-Mobile doesn't have a really great, business internet connection service, which is something that both of its other competitors have in one way or another. Verizon with its Fios plan and AT&T with its Unet across different parts of the U.S. So that would, put it in a position where it could be competitive in a way that it's not currently able to be with its counterparts in the industry.
Oh, that's really interesting. So is there going to be any oversight of that? Like the FCC doesn't have to get involved in that kind of acquisition, but they do have to get involved in this Mint Mobile, Ultra Mobile acquisition. Like sometimes I'm just so confused. Like when does it flag for the FCC and when does it not?
The big thing for the FCC is the wireless spectrum, the actual like landlines and being able to dig those lines. That's a different smaller organization that kind of measures those kind of arrangements. But the FCC is very much interested in making sure that the services that are provided over airwaves across the United States follow very specific sets of rules.
That was Russell Hawley, managing editor for commerce at CNET. Thank you as always.
Thank you for having me.
And that'll do it for this hour of All Sides. Thank you for listening to 89.7 NPR News.